have an offer here. It's very impressive.
Somebody's going there. Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started. We have three items on our agenda this afternoon. First up, we have a continued discussion of the former Armory Senior Center RFP, which was contained in the packet. I don't know if staff needed to give us any update on that, or if we can just get into some of the questions. Again, the RFP is kind of a reissue of what we had done before, although I think we are emphasizing or at least talking more about the option to entertain purchase or sale opportunities. And then we have a May 5th date, I believe, as far as the due date for getting these in. Who wants to start? Any comments from staff, first off? It's pretty self-explanatory, so Mr. Wojcik and then Mr. Hickey.
Is the mayor going to be here today?
I mean, no, I don't believe so. He'll be late, at least.
Okay. I mean, the issue that I have, and I, you know, regardless of how we go forward, I just caution how much money we obligate ourselves for. Because right now, if the mayor, and we haven't had a chance for him to weigh in, if he's going to veto any sale, and there's three council members that don't want to sell it, we should probably be factoring that into our process. And, you know, but either way, whatever we do in this process, it's important that we remember when we sign these contracts, you know, whether it's if we get a full bid purchase price that's presented to us by a commercial realtor, we pay that commission regardless of whether or not we accept it. So my biggest concern is just let's be sure we're not expending money on options that we're not going to follow through on. Staff has limited time and we have limited money.
Okay. Mr. Hickey?
I just had a question. So we've got a May 5th date. So last time we treated it like it was a sealed bid, you know, 1 minute passed, we can't accept anything. So certainly need a work to date if they want to be guaranteed consideration. But my question would be the scenario, so say it's May 6th and someone submits something. Again, if they want guaranteed consideration, they have to have it in on time. But if there's time available, I mean, are we treating it like, nope, you missed the deadline, you can't get it in? Because I wasn't clear on that last time. And in the end, we said, no, if it's not exactly on time, we're not even going to look at it. So at this point, you would hope that anybody who's interested has had plenty of notice and this shouldn't be an issue. But in case that situation comes up, I just want to know how we're going to handle it.
Well, and I think last time the issue was we had a late submission, but it was like several weeks or months later, so there was a question of whether that was equitable, since that submission actually had time to hear us debate or vet the proposal that had made it on time. So I'm okay with, you know, if they get it in the next morning or something like that.
I said next morning as an example. So if it's a week late or 2 weeks late, if there's no time to evaluate it, then I certainly understand. So if they want consideration, they have to have it in on time. But I just want to understand what the process is. Are we saying we will not accept late proposals, or we're saying you have no guarantee that we'll consider it if it's not in on time?
Okay. Mr. Campbell?
I won't support the RFP going out, but I would not accept a late application. It just, there's no point. Like, we have complete control of the process right now. We won't accept late applications. That's a pretty trivial thing for people to do 2 or 3 months out from when we're looking to get these. Get them in on time.
Ms. Johnson?
I'm going to agree with that, just because a deadline is a deadline. And I mean, when you're in college and you submit a paper, if you're late, you don't pass. So I'm going to agree with the deadline situation on that.
Okay. Others okay with sticking with a deadline? I'm fine with that. I mean, that's why we put a date out there. There's plenty of time. I really don't know that we're going to get that many submissions anyway. We're going to get probably maybe a retooling of some that we've already seen. And that's about it. So I'm okay with sticking with the deadline. And if you don't make the deadline, we don't consider it.
Yeah, it's not like we're saying it's got to be in by Friday. We're talking months.
Anybody else?
Just
Mr. Bilderback?
Aaron, just want to make sure, looking through here again, the question has come up to me that we had talked earlier about making sure that anybody interested would make understood that they could not change the exterior of the building. Just want to make sure that we point that out as well.
Yeah, to be honest, that is something that I was kind of thinking about too. We do mention in the initial paragraph of the description that it's on the National Register of Historic Places, but we don't really get into details with that. So I think one easy way to address that is in that first, I guess it's item two, property description, I would add that, and so it's listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and as well as designated as a landmark property under the city's current ordinance, and then I'll attach a copy of the current ordinance, and then everybody getting the RFP will see what the requirements are for a landmark property. And I think that should address the issue of what's allowed to be done or not with the building.
I just want to make sure that we make it perfect, you know, because again, as Mr. Hickey pointed out, he's correct, there was a lot of leftover thoughts last time of what meant and what didn't mean. So I just think we need to make sure we're perfectly clear this time, what we're looking for and what we're not looking for, as much as we can be. I realize there's going to be some overlap or some things that will come up during the questioning period, but I do think we need to be clear what we're expecting.
And I think that makes sense. In the paragraph where you talk about the parking lots, we mentioned that there are some possible impediments there. So, and I know we said that we could put the exclusion in the deed, but it's probably more upfront to put it somewhere in that paragraph that says, hey, there's something you should be aware of here.
Yeah, I'll add that note, and then, I'll attach the ordinance as well.
Well, if we're truly committed to the preservation of this building that's on the registrar, we could certainly put in there too that improvements, renovations will be done to the Secretary of Interior standards.
But the fact is, there's been enough changes from the interior of that building already. So I think trying to put any restrictions on the interior of that building might be.
And I meant the Secretary of the standards.
Right, but I understand. But I just
and they would factor that in.
When you start talking about the Secretary of Interior stuff, that also talks about the interior of the building. When you start referencing that. So I want to be a little careful because the inside of that building has been altered many, many times over.
And I can note, too, that our ordinance does state that for landmark properties, one, we focus on the exterior, but two, that any work on the exterior does have to meet the Secretary of Interior standards.
That would be fine.
We do cover that in the ordinance, too, that they'll have to meet those standards if they do anything with it.
Any other comments or questions? Mr. Ruska?
Aaron, one of the things I've noticed is the picture on page two shows numerous signs and different kind of banners and so on. So are we going to have any kind of restrictions on that? We're talking about leaving the building as it is, but a lot of businesses or options that might want to go in there are going to look for some ability to have some signage or some identification. So right. Do we have any parameters on that, or is it depends? Or
generally, so one, it would fall under the zoning, which would have their sign requirements, but then for something like this, for signage on a landmark property, it would have to go through the Heritage Preservation Commission for approval. So the signage that you see right now, my assumption would not have been approved by the Heritage Preservation Commission, but again, this was done before the ordinance was enacted. So moving forward, it would be kind of twofold. One, they would have to meet the zoning requirements, whatever the signage is, but two, they would have to get approval. So there is ways to sign historic buildings, most definitely, but it would have to be something that fits, I guess, in with that historic integrity of the building. But yeah, it would require approval.
Mr. Wood,
is it? And there's too a difference between permanent signage and banners. I mean, a lot of world class museums all over the world will put up banners, and that's not
that's not something that we would. The Heritage Preservation Commission at least would not look at that part of it. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Anyone else? This is on the consent agenda for this evening. So how do you want to handle?
Well, I'll make the one fix, and I can have it ready for tonight. That's pretty easy. I mean, basically, all I'm going to do is just add the wording that, in addition, this is designated as a landmark property in the city's current ordinance. So I can make that addition quick, and I can print it out, at least that part, and have it for you guys to be able to see it tonight at the meeting. And then when the actual RFP package, I'll include the copy of the whole ordinance. It is like 15 pages long, so I don't know that we need to add it for tonight, but I will attach the ordinance then when we release the RFP.
All right, Mr. Mayor, just in time, Councilmember Wojcik raised a question related to the armory, so I'll let him.
Ultimately, we've got, at this point, we've got a divided council, and whether or not we'd be willing to sell that building or not, and we'll have a potential for RFP tonight, and I think it's important to know if this is something that's going to be vetoed or not, because it can take the sale off the table if someone else has a veto.
No, I don't think it will be vetoed. I think we should continue to go forward and see what we get.
So the sale of the building is on the table?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Any other comments? All right, then we'll look for the revised version for this evening.
And I apologize for being late. We have the Police Civil Service Commission meeting, their annual meeting today. So I've got done in 30 minutes. So here. Quick. We'll need a new member on there because one of them was termed out. So before April 1st, I will have one for. That's only three people on that. But we'll need a new member, and we'll start advertising for it.
Okay. Moving on to our next topic for this afternoon, discussion of staff authorized changes to approve conditional use permits and additional provisions for TIF development assistance. Again, we have the staff recommendations in our packet. Mr. Spade, do you want to make any comments?
Well, this was being brought back to the council in response to the concerns that were brought up a couple of weeks ago. In regard to the concerns about the Broadway Center project, when that discussion ensued here a few weeks back, staff indicated we'd take a look at the ordinance to see what we may be able to suggest that would help maybe clarify and provide a little additional opportunity for either Planning Commission and or Council to have input into those changes. I'd been working on something previously anyway, and as it relates to the TIF development agreements. So then after the council discussion, we convened a meeting with planning staff, city attorney, and our admin staff, and looked at the provisions there in section 61.148 of the city's zoning ordinance and land development manual. And the staff's suggestions are laid out there. And you can see the red line copy of those changes. One suggestion, Gary and I were having a conversation actually on Friday, and we just didn't have a chance to follow through until just a short time ago with a few other staff, is we were thinking maybe that in addition to what's there in red line under the letter G there, where it indicates a significant change in the essence or character of the project as approved, to potentially add a little bit of language to that to state something to the effect that it would include the elimination of one of the major approved elements of the project, such as elimination of the residential, retail, commercial, or hotel elements in a project. Not to get down to specific little uses, you know, like changing from a coffee shop to a sit-down restaurant or something like that, but more so the major types of elements that are in mixed-use or multi-use projects. The only other thing I just wanted to add is, as I mentioned, I've been working with our TIF bond attorney on a few changes to provisions in the in TIF development assistance agreements. And so we have recently changed that language that relates to expiration. You may remember a while back, you probably heard me mention the term the 90-day shot clock. We actually have changed that a little bit here since then. And so now we're suggesting that the language have a 180-day time frame within which the developer has to execute that development agreement, get their financing in place, and start construction, which essentially means, you know, getting footings and foundation underway, not just pulling the permit. So we think that will help us to prevent situations like we had on the one instance.
All right, Ms.
Ruska? Are they still able to file for an extension if they want, so they can still do that? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
The point of the 180 days, subsequent to our issues on the Broadway Center, we found that there were two other projects in the Twin Cities by very large developers, Mortenson and United Properties, that both had to go in for 6 month extensions because they could not get their financing in place. So we thought by having 180 days with the possibility of an extension and tying it to both the getting a building permit and the financing, it may take 4 months to get the financing in a you know, 30 days to get the building permit or something. So it gives a little more flexibility.
So we could choose to deny the extension, even if
you
they
obviously
apply.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Yep.
I'll make sure. All right, Mr. Campion.
So, reading this, I don't feel like it goes very far to getting to the core issue. And it's not to like admonish staff. Just the core issue that we seem to be struggling with is this major or minor change. And this kind of, I think I counted like 15 changes, but I don't really see much in the scope change. Like the scope is still essentially the same. And so, you know, one of my questions was just like, is staff seeing this as just is there some other direction here that's being taken, or where are we trying to go? Because to me, this just doesn't get to the core issue of when is something major, when is something minor, which seems to be the issue that we struggle with consistently.
Well, I mean, I'm going to defer to planning staff as it relates to section 61.148 here. You know, they're the staff that's responsible for administering the ordinance, so I would defer to them on that. I guess as I looked at it, I kind of thought we were dealing with that, but apparently, you know, there are still issues out there, and maybe we need to continue working to tweak it.
Well, this isn't always the best format to handle these sorts of conversations in, but I think that, like, what I struggle with a little bit is essentially the entirety of the ordinance is going to boil down to point G. You know, a significant change in the essence of character of the project as approved. Now, you know, what constitutes a significant change is still, I mean, all we've done is rearticulated the core problem here, which is that there's not seemingly consensus on what is a significant or insignificant change.
Mitzi, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I would like to, thank you. Gary had thrown out some additional language for us to add to G, which I think will be helpful. And it says that it would include elimination of one of the major approved elements of the project, such as elimination of residential, retail, and commercial/commercial, or hotel elements. But removing those elements, really changing a very significant change to
sure.
character and essence. I will be very honest in that these provisions and the inflexibility that's being added to projects by conditions that the council wishes to put on them is an administrative nightmare, because they stay on the project for the entire life of the project. So 10 years, 15, 20 years down the road, after a project's approved, if somebody wants to change an element, they need to replace the siding, put new windows in, change the doors, do maintenance on a building, and they can't find the same exact materials that match what was approved, we're stuck. We have to come back to the council through an arduous process because of maintenance and reasonable modifications to a building that are required to keep it in good condition. And I have a hard time with that, to be quite honest, because once we've had a project approved, the bulk of that project, its size, its location, its general feel and compatibility with its neighboring properties has already been decided. And as we move forward in time, we have to have something that is reasonably administrable, and the property owners need to have something that they can reasonably rely on that they can maintain.
I would also say, after being around here a long time, this has only been an issue lately. We haven't had that issue for 30 years. So, and the two biggest issues have been the Broadgate Center project and the windows on the 501 First. I mean, when you look at the rest of the issues, they were fairly minor. I mean, not that the location of gas meters isn't a big deal, or whether you have a glass railing or a spindle railing on it. But, you know, are people really going to worry about those long term? And that's where, over the years, what's happened is the planning staff has dealt with this on a lot of occasions, and they deal with it on projects that are currently being acted upon, and they have to make a judgment. You know, is this against kind of what the council was saying when the project went forward? And they use their best judgment, and they're held accountable for it. And you know, that does provide some flexibility. Some of the plans, you know, that people provide, they don't show, you know, where the vents are on heating systems, when you see the beautiful renderings, they don't have that on there. In some cases, they don't have the items on there that they need for the code. So you're either going to say everything has to come back, or you're going to have to provide some flexibility. And if you see something you didn't like, then we'll have to put something to address it. We put things in there to address the things some of you had concerns about on the Broadway Center project.
Quick question for our city attorney. Maybe this goes to the concept of intent. Oftentimes we do a project and there's a certain intended purpose, obviously, with a number of conditions and so on and so forth. And I think what you're talking about is what planning staff has done in the past anyway, is so long as the project still meets the intent, as near as they can determine, they might very well approve a change. Your example, you railing, glass railing versus metal railing, but was the intent of the project still the same? Or does it change such that it should come back through the process? Mr. Bildbeck?
See, the problem that I have, Gary, in all honesty, when I start looking at this, is when they make a three-story change.
Like that wouldn't be allowed under this.
But my question is...
Wouldn't be allowed three different ways under this.
Right, but this is the problem. This is where we have to struggle with, because you're asking us to approve TIF dollars, you're asking us, and so when something major that could change the overall character of the building, what it's used for, what it's not for, I have a problem with that. And I think those are, I believe that's what Mr. Campion is saying as well, that we need to have an idea of what, and we've asked, what's the difference between major and minor? Help us. Help us figure out what major and minor mean. And then we can probably sit down and go along with what you're saying, but not knowing. It's hard for us as well.
One's eliminated three times though, Mark. I mean, there's three things in here prevented that. So you're back to, and if you change put the language in relating to the uses, that's one of the ways that it's done. But
I mean, we just saw that, and that's a question to me. I mean, we're responsible to our constituents to make sure that we spend the money wisely. So what we're voting on initially in passing is what needs to try to maintain itself when it comes back to us.
I understand, but I'm also pointing out this happened, in my opinion, twice.
I understand, but unfortunately, when it happens, it's not a fun spot to sit in.
Yeah. Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Campion.
So, I mean, I don't think we're ever going to be able to exhaustively define ever possible change. So we say it's not in here, but it says examples of minor changes may include but are not limited to, then they list minor changes. Then they talk about what's not allowed or what is allowed, an increase or decrease in the floor area that results by this percentage, change in the building coverage in a lot. So, I mean, it's never going to be completely exhaustive. So they've put a lot of detail in here. We're not going to be able to cover every instance. So we could say that it's not addressed, but it is.
Mr. Campion.
I mean, I find that line of argument pretty weak. And the reason I find it weak is because literally the context here can define any change. It's both simultaneously too narrow in some ways, and then it's ridiculously large. You know, it's height, the amount of floor area, exterior facades. Like, that is basically the physical design of the building can be modified through this process. Now, I want to enable staff in this way. Like, my goal is to, frankly, get some of this off of our hands. So when I hear this described as an administrative nightmare, like, you have to understand that there's a balance, right? There's a balance to what I want to be held accountable for. When we go and pass a special district and we say we're going to build XYZ, and then they show up and that's not built, the constituents hold me responsible, not staff. They don't come and you know, knock on staff's door to complain. They come yell at me. So I want to know when I approve something, what's going to get built, because that is imperative for this to work out as a representative government. Otherwise, why have a neighborhood meeting? You know, why have all these other processes that attempt to bring the neighborhoods into this if we're then going to say, well, as a type one, you can actually adjust anything in this process? That is fundamentally against what people on this council say that they stand for. If you're for engaging the community, if you're for building that, then we have to define what a minor adjustment is. Otherwise, no one should sleep at night next to a project because, you know, any of these elements can change. That's significant changes.
Mr. Russ, well, Ms. Mitzi, why don't you comment? You have your hand up.
two things. Number one is I think it's important for the council to understand there's really about a three-step process that a developer might go through when they're looking at a project. And I'll take it a restricted or incentive development plan as an example. The preliminary plan is a test of whether or not it's an approvable project. It's a test. So their investment is supposed to be minimal. It's a basic site design and bulk of a building and location. If that meets the test and it's considered approvable, then they invest in this next level of more detailed architectural drawings and images and a more detailed site plan and even some floor plans. But they're not building plans. If that project gets approval through that next set of public hearings, there's a much more significant investment. Put in the detailed floor plates, the detailed architectural and structural engineering plans that then sometimes will dictate where do those vents have to be, where are the electrical connections, where, you know, the emergency exits, what windows are actually available on the market now that it's taken us 9 months or 12 months to get to this point in the project. And there are changes. There are changes because that's really just how things progress, because there's another level of detail. What I'd like to do is to be able to have staff have the flexibility to acknowledge that those are reasonable changes, because those levels of detail are not known when council acts on a project, and that we have the ability to administer approving and issuing permits without having to come back.
Yeah, I agree with that direction. My problem is that when a side of a building, an entire facade of a building loses windows, like, right? So we all agree that that's major, right? I don't think that there should be any...
We all agree it'll never happen again.
but then it does happen, and then we have to... So. Yeah.
Mr. Ruska.
Well, I guess at this point, what we're stumbling around here with is we need to make a decision, and I think we need to bring this forward for a vote from some of us, and if it doesn't work and it doesn't get approved, then we can go back to the drawing board. But, you know, frankly, I'm okay with it. I think it's a good step. We've identified some things. We've learned a few things, but... I haven't, in all my years, I haven't seen a lot of issues with this. So, you know, there's been a couple here lately, but I think we've identified that and agreed and put some things in here to keep it from that. And now I think it's time to make a decision.
Mr. Wojcik.
I would say that there's a huge, huge difference between changes that are driven by code requirements that would come out in the building design process and changes that are not required. I would say that these issues have been going on for 30 or 40 years. The difference is, come around 2008, neighborhoods started getting the power to speak up a little bit more and pointing to some of this happening. The one that still drives me nuts is Shops on Second. We approved that project with a outdoor seating area and a door to it on the corner of 16th and Second Street, and magically, that door went away, the plaza went away, and the remaining windows have pizza boxes stacked up in it. There is no code requirement that drove that change. And it, you know, in the opinion of the neighbors who were part of that process, it was very disingenuous towards what we approved. There are a lot of cities have a very good way of handling it. It takes the pressure off of staff to a great deal and takes it off the council. They have architectural review for these kind of standards. That's certainly another option. When we say that we have to do one or the other, that's not true. We can certainly have independent architectural review. I can completely respect when somebody has to put in a vent hood or move a window because of electrical. I totally understand that. I don't want that to come back to us. But when the changes are being done to just cheapen up a building, use cheaper materials, that bothers me a lot. And we've seen plenty of that over the years too. And then part of giving this discretion to staff is always going to be based on how those decisions are being made. And I can't help but point towards taking three stories off a building, eliminating a use, and that was a staff decision that the council wasn't made aware of. And particularly perplexing is the building got $20 million cheaper, yet somehow the city was putting the same amount of public assistance into it. So these are real issues. I do think that, as Mr. Campion said, we do need to get additional specifications for certain items. One that sticks out to me is a decrease in transparency at the ground floor, because that tends to be a huge issue, particularly in urban design. Removing windows and doors, not like what was done on the project in Kutsky Park, the Nicholas. That's certainly something that should represent. I have had a note on here too that anytime there's a change in use, which means an elimination or the addition of a use, that's just blanket. You're going back to the council at that point. I do think I agree with Mr. Ruska. We should have a policy on this, and we can bring it up for a vote. And of course, along with those votes, we can amend it however we see fit as well. And but I do think that this isn't happening because all of the changes have been noble and for the betterment of the community. We've had a lot of buildings that have just been cheapened down behind our backs, and we need to address that circumstance.
I just wanted to reiterate, or at least make sure I understood Mr. Newman's comment. You were saying that had this language been in place as proposed, the three-story change would not have been approvable by staff. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to fix.
Would the changes at Shops on Second have been allowed? To me, that's in that gray area, and it's...
Yeah, I'd say that's getting into the gray area. That's where, you know, the staff exercise and discretion. I don't remember the details of that project.
And in fairness, staff didn't execute any discretion. They just didn't follow the rules.
Yeah. I'm not going to beat a dead horse. There's one kind of technical change I was trying to understand. So in subdivision 2A, it looks like we struck use changes for non... or for. So the struck language has a change in use of the property. And then the replacement clause actually has no reference to a change in use. Is there coverage in this document for a change of use?
Isn't that what you're suggesting adding to G?
Yes, it would come under G. And what we want to do is be really careful about how we refer to that, because if we technically say change of use, it could mean the change of something that seems like a restaurant but has more than 50% of its sales in liquor. Mm-hmm. So that it becomes a bar. Changing from that use to a sit-down restaurant that is less than 50% of their sales in liquor. We don't want to have that level of inflexibility. So
I'm not sure we agree.
Okay.
You think that the placement of a restaurant in kind of a B1 bordering a neighborhood should be handled the same way as placement of a bar in that same area?
No, a B1, you'd have to go through a conditional use permit specifically for a bar.
I specifically want uses that are going to infuriate the residents that have to live around them to come back. I don't want there to be a channel I'm not trying to make a joke. Like, this is my goal here with this entire process, is that those changes your staff and you are not getting arm twisted to allow that to happen, because I don't want that to happen.
That's the purpose of zoning. So the conditional use permit is separate from just looking at standard zoning.
Right.
If you have a conditional use permit that went through some specific approval for what they're establishing, if they want to insert another use that's already permitted, type 1 permitted in that zoning district, could put it on the adjacent property or that one, why would we not allow it to be put in the conditional use property? You'd have no action on another piece.
Right. It depends how we got to that point, right? So if if as part of their action before the council, they've attested to not doing that, then my challenge is they said they would not do that, and then they go and do that.
If it was very clearly documented that they were not going to do it, we would not sign off on it.
Which brings me to my entire other point about testimony before the council. But ultimately, that's the goal here, right? The goal is that we can feel comfortable. That's my entire thing, is I want to feel comfortable when something is passed, that we have some understanding of what is going to be developed there. When they go to all the effort of presenting a development to us with entrances or with windows or with, you know, fancy renderings, and then they go to you guys and change that, that erodes this trust at this level, and that erodes my ability to defend the project to the general citizenry of Rochester. So I think that there's this, we do have to establish it. So I appreciate Councilmember Ruska's statement here. We do have to have an operating norm. I want to establish that. We'll work to hammer that out. But I think these edge cases are so critical here. I'd rather have you, frankly, kick it back up more often than not and say, this is one we weren't certain about. Let's establish a precedent here about how we want to move forward. That, to me, at least will have some context of doing this, but it feels as if sometimes little things come back, and sometimes I won't beat that horse.
Well, I think we all at least agree that this is moving us further down the road towards our goal.
Oh, road.
you're not convinced we're far enough.
Oh, right. That's okay.
But at least we're moving in the right direction. I just wanted to make that comment.
We've argued this one enough for a day, I'd say.
Okay. Anyone else? Ms. Johnson, any comments? Or?
No.
Ms. Baker.
Yep. I'm wondering if the council would like us to try to insert some language that speaks to a minor change cannot result in change that will reduce the quality or durability of materials.
That would make me very happy.
I would be happy with that. You could live with that.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
We'll modify this some when we bring it back.
Thank you. Do we need to bring it back to a committee of the whole, or can we bring it back?
No,
I think we'll come up with a few other suggestions and bring it forward.
Bring it forward.
So we can make those changes and bring it back or bring it forward to for some action as soon as you're ready.
Let me just bounce an idea off. The one thing I'm interested in too is the permeability of buildings, particularly at the pedestrian level. And when you say that diminish the quality or of the materials, cities like Woodbury would include glass as being a high quality material because it adds permeability to the building. Would planning staff view that similarly, or?
I'd actually like to add another item onto this that speaks directly
Perfect.
To that because. Okay. Changing the transparency or activity level at the pedestrian level at the street level can significantly change the distance of a project. So if it helps to get this through the process by spelling that out, I think we can add a little more language that speaks to cannot result in some percentage change of transparency at the ground floor or a loss of an active use or at that.
That would honestly address probably two-thirds of the many, many issues that I've had. It's the changes at the pedestrian scale.
All right. Anything else? Good. We'll look for that. Moving on to our third item this afternoon, discussion of updated city business incentive policies. Mr. Spaeth had included a document. I had asked. I was having a hard time figuring out what changed. So he did send out a highlighted version. Hopefully everyone had a chance to see that. So that you could tell exactly what they were proposing to be changed. But
that was helpful, thank you.
So, Mr. Spaeth?
Yeah, I apologize. I should have sent that out last week when I actually put it in the packet. I was scrambling to get this done, get it out. This is an item that, on a staff level, we've talked about bringing back for some time. From time to time, we've went back and looked at the we refer to as our TIF policies or our development incentive policies. It had been actually probably about, I think in 2007 was the last time we actually brought something back formally. And then in 2011, Doug Knott and I were working on some revisions to the city's policies. And for whatever reason, it just got put on the back burner. And we felt this is the time to bring it back to the council, just because, quite frankly, I don't recall the time in the 20 years I've been here where we got half a dozen TIF projects going on at the same time. That's a lot. So I felt like I needed some direction from the council. I wanted to make sure everybody had what they felt comfortable with in terms of the priorities for the use of tax increment financing. The previous iterations of the policies had talked about, these opportunities or the times when you use development incentives, for instance, redevelopment projects or housing projects or economic development projects where we have new jobs being created or retaining jobs. But we really hadn't prioritized them. And again, with the number of requests that we're seeing in the interest that we're seeing in development, I felt like we needed to do something here. So I had kind of put together some of this information in terms of priorities, and I've had meetings with our administration staff on a number of occasions, and
So this is what we've suggested. So the language in the yellow is essentially the new language in the city's development incentive policies. So in terms of the priorities, we had suggested that the first three there, which would be development or redevelopment projects that are included in the DMC development boundary, those would be a priority. Again, economic developments, we're getting job creation with living wages, and then, you know, again, affordable housing TIF districts. And I would like to just make a real quick point as it relates to number three on the housing TIF districts. I got a couple emails from a couple council members today about that question about where the 40% come from. That actually comes out of state statute. That's the minimum requirement for a housing TIF district. Most of the housing TIF districts that we're doing in the city today actually are 100% affordable units at 60% median. Typically, these are the types of projects, for instance, that like Joe Weiss does or others, and they're competitive. They're going after housing tax credits or housing revenue bonds, which a lot of times make up the lion's share of their project financing. And in order to compete well and garner the points needed to get those tax credits or whatever, they've got to basically make all their units affordable. And so that's what we're seeing. But in reality, the statute says only 40, or 40 is the minimum. So that's where that number actually came from. And someone, I think, also asked me the question about A through D there. Those are, I took those essentially and put them in our policies because they're also in our housing assistance criteria checklist that was developed about 4 or 5 years ago. We put that together. So when, for instance, somebody's coming forward, a lot of times we might have multiple projects that are seeking tax credits or some other assistance of some sort. It gives the council a bit of background information on the project and helps you, prioritize maybe which projects you would feel you'd want to push your support toward. So that's where those actually came from, out of there. Then the other bigger change that we put in there is actually under number four, which relate to other redevelopment projects, and that, at least in my mind, is not quite as high of a priority as those first three that were listed previous to that. We have put together a few considerations there listed under A through D, which we feel would help the council as well in terms of trying to determine, you know, which of those types of projects you feel would warrant potentially providing assistance to, somehow distinguishing one from another. So that's why that's in there. Really, other than that, I mean, the only other big changes were, under six, the provisions under C, we've indicated as a suggestion that redevelopment projects should leverage the maximum private investment possible, and that the goal was, you know, essentially one-tenth public to private, and then trying
that
to...
That language changed a little bit.
Yes, we did change that a little bit. And then not more than 75% of the increment coming off of a project going to reimburse the developer for their costs, which may provide an opportunity to capture some of that increment to use for other public improvements that may be deemed necessary. So that's really about the extent of the changes. Oh, I take that back. I guess we did have the, it's been in here for a while, but I guess the council hasn't seen it. For the housing TIF districts, we've put in those couple of things there related to kind of a threshold of no more than, for instance, $12,000 per dwelling unit, or a maximum of 15 years of increment going to the project. Typically, these are the types of projects I was just talking about before, where someone's getting housing tax credits or revenue bonds, and they're just looking to fill a small portion of the gap with some increment to get them over the hump. So we felt that was reasonable in that case.
Mr. Newman, then Mr. Hickey.
If I could just comment on the redevelopment projects outside the downtown have always been a bit of a dilemma for the city. Back in the in the day the city took a tougher approach than most communities and said, we're going to restrict redevelopment projects to the downtown. So we didn't want to do small redevelopment projects in every neighborhood throughout the city, or you just end up with a whole large number of TIF projects. It was an attempt to try and reduce the number of TIF projects that the city does. The two projects we've done that are outside the downtown now as redevelopment projects really were the First Homes projects on Civic Center Drive and the Girard project on the Crick. And the other one that's probably going to request it is going to be the Miracle Mile project. So now all of those three projects, we're trying to look at what are some examples on those projects that are unique, that kind of generate some support. Because our only concern, and you may not have that concern, is do we want to be in the business of redeveloping every neighborhood shopping center that's now become a bit blighted to us? That's going a little far. But so that's why we tried to define some things to look at regarding what kind of distress it's in and proximity to the downtown and those things of that nature. You know, those are just things we came up with, and you may have other ideas on those. But just trying to create some demarcation between doing redevelopment projects all over the community. At some point, you know, some of these, when you're redoing an old shopping center, it maybe is necessary, but what do you look at to determine how do you get into that, and where do you stop once you get?
Ms. Baker?
In terms of incentivizing the kind of development that's going to help this community move toward addressing some of our transportation challenges, providing more housing and transportation choices, I would ask that the council not close the door on the idea that we can revisit this policy later in the year, and really use the comprehensive plan and the corridors that are identified as priorities for redevelopment. It's feeding into your policy for using TIF money. We don't have a lot of tools to incentivize these things to happen, and this is one that you do have. So I would encourage thinking about prioritizing geographic locations that fit with that vision and that help us move toward that plus rapid transit and PRT.
Well, that's consistent with number five that's in there. But we don't have that information yet, but we would 100% agree with what Mitzi said.
Right. Yeah, it's in there. At this particular point in time, it wasn't listed as the priority, but I think down the road, as we gather more information, we'd want to take another look at that.
I agree with that. We should certainly feel free to reevaluate the policy periodically. The thing I like about both this item and the last agenda item is I think it's a win all the way around. Adding more clarity to these kinds of policies is a win for the developers. It gives them more an idea of what to expect. It gives our staff more better footing in terms of evaluating projects, and it gives us better clarity in terms of how we render a decision. So I like that aspect. Mr. Ruska, then Mr. Campy.
Terry, could you just kind of doing some math here? I came up with the 60% of the median income at like $38,000-$39,000. And it says here in point, is that about right or not?
Yeah, about 40,000
yeah,
right now.
It's 65 median income, say 60%.
Yeah.
So in your point three, it says at least 40% of the units kind of be affordable to the people of that. But who determines, who and how is that determined, what that affordable amount is?
The 40% you mean?
Not
following you.
It says at least 40% of the units
have
to be affordable.
You mean who decides if they are affordable or not?
Right, what that amount needs to be.
Oh, well, that's the 60% AMI is determined each year by the state. MHFA puts for each MSA out there.
Okay.
So they provide what that figure is. You know. So again, like you said, right, 60% AMI right now is right around 40,000.
Right.
Yeah, that's their determination. And then when...
But you have to make that result into a rent amount. Right?
Yes.
So who determines that amount?
Oh, that's based on the 30% of your...
30%? Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So you take that 40,000,
yep,
you do the calc, and
yep,
yeah, gets you what your maximum rent can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the state has that all. You can go to MHFA's website, and they've got tables of what that is and what the rents and stuff would be. But the city, like if we're doing a TIF project, if we're just a straight-out TIF project, the city would be responsible... I mean, we'd have to do the verification. We'd make them provide a certification and sign off on it. normally with these housing projects, again, they're seeking tax credits or bonding, so MHFA does that, so we don't have to do the day-to-day verification of the incomes and all that stuff.
So taking Mr. Ruska's math one step further and the 40,000, the 30%, just using rough numbers, that's going to equate to about $1,000 a month.
Yep.
Is considered affordable.
Yep.
Or less.
Yep.
12 months.
Yep,
so that's 40,000.
And for affordable, when we talk about that, as a brand name, doesn't mean it's affordable to all people.
No,
obviously it's not.
Right.
But at least I want to kind of get an idea of what we're targeting.
Yep.
And so I have two things. So we can define our own affordable guidelines for this, correct?
For the housing TIF districts, as long as you're at least 40% at 60, you could go beyond that if you wanted to.
We aren't constrained. Are we constrained by that because that is the minimum defined for use of TIF?
Only for a housing TIF district?
Right.
That's a minimum. But for these other projects that we've done, I think Gary mentioned before, like for instance over in the Kutsky neighborhood, the Kutsky place, you don't have any constraints there. You could put whatever you wanted on it.
The only other slight suggestion I'd have is that the objectives come before the priorities, because I think the objectives in this document are the part where the council should probably be providing the most, the objectives and priorities, but it seems like the priorities actually come from the objectives.
Yeah.
The objectives are a little bit more general. I think in terms of a guidance document, if this was a charity or, you know, if this is an executive board of the city, which I believe we are, the standard here would be to keep us out of kind of how this is enacted, much more of like steering at the objective level. And so from the objectives, I thought the objective statements were really get to the heart of what we're trying to do.
Yes.
The only specific I was going to feedback is kind of I think some of the reference to downtown master plan and the DMC felt a little heavy-handed. Like, we can probably just say, you know, redevelopment of the downtown, and it doesn't have to be the DMC plan or the downtown master plan. It can be more generic than that to me. Those documents, I mean, gosh, hopefully they're here for a long time. We paid enough for them, but I think they'll come and go, and the objectives can kind of stand, I think, separate from them.
So under the objectives, Nick, as I understand it, you're suggesting under A, for instance, just to encourage development or redevelopment consistent with the goals and
objectives of the city of Rochester would be fine. And then for priorities, I think the priority to say we're going to prioritize DMC plan that's a slam dunk to me. That's the way to do it. Just want to make sure, like, I don't think our objective is that. Our objective is actually redevelopment, I guess.
Noted, and appreciate the input. Right. We'll make those changes. Mr. Wonder.
Well, I had 4 points when I was going through this, and I think Mitzi, because she nailed my first one, in that hitting these transit-connected corridors, particularly the high-frequency transit ones, is probably going to be as important as the downtown, because we just don't have enough land downtown. We haven't opened enough for intense development, so we see these ridiculous land transaction prices. And that's going to be like taking the release valve, opening it up on a pressure cooker when we do that. So that's very important to me, that we do revisit this with a comp plan coming out. Second part is, and I agree with Mr. Campion's statement, that it's important that we focus not necessarily on specific geographies, but rather productive places. And this should be there's plenty of things we do in a quasi-judicial capacity. This isn't one of them. This is something where we can figure out how we get the best benefit for our people on a case-by-case basis. And there are just a lot of tools and techniques out there that we have not used in the past, looking at non-development related benefits, things like community benefit agreements, which a lot of communities do, ensuring that you know, the result of this development is going to be something that's positive. We're not just creating a bunch of low-wage jobs. You know, we can, you know, insist on living wage jobs as exchange for our participation in this. We can put in affordable housing, and for the non-housing ones, we have great leverage. We can put in determine the rules that work best. I do think the 1 in 10 and the 75%, I just think that those are too generous, even today. Which, by the way, 1/10 turns out to be is nine times the private portion is 9 times the public portion. I think those are too generous. I'd like to see a step back from that 1 in 10 to maybe more like a 1 in 15, and that 75% knock it back to 60. Because the assumption you're making, what you have to remember here, is just because we're getting new property doesn't mean we have
don't have new expenses that go along with it. If we had 200 housing units, that's 200 more people that may be calling public safety. That's 200 more units that are going to have a need for parkland. And if you take all the increment that's in this building and give it back to the developer, you've taken an already difficult budget situation and you've continued to make it worse. So I do hope we're reserved on that. And then one part, and I don't know where we put it in, I do agree with Mr. Campion that we should put the objectives first, figure out what we're trying to accomplish with this policy. But I do think that we need to put some explicit language in there about critically evaluating the business cases. Briefly digging into the numbers, when we looked at the Hammes one, I pointed out a few things that were would have significantly changed the return on investment calculation. It did not look to be very fair numbers that were being used to not reflect the reality on the ground in Rochester. And so I do think we need to make sure that we're not subsidizing things that don't need to be, and I think we need to do a lot more in digging into those business cases before we're willing to do that, and I think that's going to also reduce the amount that we're giving out in these subsidies. I also think we should not be paying for competitive advantages. Example being with the Hammes one, we would not want to subsidize a subway or a skyway connection there because their retail will be competing with the retail that's on the street across the street. Those kind of things, when we're picking winners and losers with our tax policies, is not necessarily productive either. And add one more in here. pet peeve of mine, we have to make sure that if a developer is willing to exceed a reasonable market price for land, that results in a decrease on their return on investment, not an increase in public subsidy going into their project. Because as soon as we start subsidizing land purchase prices, we're going to keep doing it forever and ever and ever. So we got to make sure that if people are exceeding reasonable land transactions, that we're not going to subsidize that with them.
Mr. Newman?
Yeah, if I could comment, Michael and I don't agree on this. He knows it, and I know it. Currently the projects we've been having, that we've had come in, have been kind of in that 9-to-1 range. And I think without the assistance we would have provided, the Alanis project probably would have been 10-to-1. I don't think that project would have gone forward. I don't think the housing project down on First Avenue that we're proposing right now, I don't think that would go forward. I do think we're kind of in a situation, if you don't want to provide the subsidies, the true test will be sometimes when a project goes away, mm-hmm. or multiple projects go away. The Broadway Center project had difficulty proceeding under the level of assistance that we provided. You'll know it when they don't happen. And I don't know that this is the right stage for that when you're in the first blush of the DMC project. We've said that our office's view is down the road. We would suggest ratcheting up the private share in comparison to the city share. But I don't know, in the first years of this major state investment, if that's the time to do that. I do think, the land prices are definitely a problem. But if the property, if the developer doesn't own the land, there's not a lot he can do. If you really want that project to proceed, I mean, the person doesn't have to, if it's a hands-off transaction, they don't mm-hmm. have to agree to sell. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you run into. And back when the DMC experts came in and said, let's do the development plan, one of the key things that they told the state legislature was we have a problem in Rochester, and that's land prices greatly exceed the market that you can get, that you can put a project up and make it fund. And that is accurate. And, we did the Biobusiness Center building. I can tell you without some of the tools we put into that building, numbers wouldn't work on that building, and we knew it going in. So, I mean, it's more expensive than to develop downtown. That's a reality. You got structured parking. You get higher land prices. It's just more expensive. So I don't disagree with Michael's intent, which is to eventually increase the ratio of private to public, and thereby you would affect, I think, some of the land prices that are going on. I personally don't think it's the right time to do that, but if you the test would be if projects go away, if you want. We do critically, in my opinion, analyze the projects. Many of the same questions Michael raised, we raised as well. I think the one thing where we parted company on the analysis on the Hammes project was the developer doesn't own that property, so the property value is what the property owner will want for it. Unless we usually try and give them less assistance, force them to go back and drive the price down. But that only works to a certain extent if you have to decide you want to do the projects.
Okay.
So is this one similar to the last, where you have enough feedback that you can make a few changes and then bring it forward for some potential action?
Yeah.
The DASPA policy?
Yep. Okay.
Other comments, questions?
No, I think hearing the feedback today and some of the things that, you know, what Mitzi brought up and whatnot, you know, we'll try to keep our finger on the pulse of this a little better than we have in the past too, you know, and we can bring it back, you know, on a more regular basis. I think that probably makes sense to take a hard look at it, you know, on a regular basis. And then if we see, you know, winds of change coming one way or the other, or gather additional information on, you know, how the comp plan shakes out with some of the TOD related things, we can tweak the policy as needed or bring it back to the council and suggest making changes as needed.
Mr. Campion.
I think that's a great idea. And to that extent, I would say when it comes back, I'd like to see the format for kind of maybe a half-year report that says the projects we've done with TIF, the value of the TIF, the amount of private money that's leveraged, the how much money went into the priorities here. Because I also think that's, like, if we're setting priorities, I want to make sure that the majority of our money is going into one of them and how they're getting allocated. And then also the objectives we think that are being met. Any ones we think are not being met, I think that sort of report,
yeah,
this is the preliminary work for us to all agree on what the objectives and priorities are. But to get the readout, I think what we need to see is here's how we're meeting those different objectives.
That's a good point. I mean, I'd be happy to put something like that together.
Don't make it too much work. I don't want it to be like a new job.
I'm actually more a spreadsheet with TIF metrics now on some of the more recent projects. So, you know, what you're talking about is sort of what I'm trying to do anyway.
Perfect.
So I'd be happy to share that.
Just sharing it isn't enough. I think we need to set aside time to. We need to set aside time to kind of chew on it as a group, too. So.
Okay. Right. No, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Mr. Wood.
All right. Just a comment about projects going away. You don't have a problem when projects go away. You have a problem when all projects go away. And, you know, it's not tax subsidies in Rochester that are making projects happen. It's the market demand that we have here, not necessarily, you know, what our particular policies are. And we have to remember that if we build 120 apartment units in one place, you know, we're taking that demand off of other places. So, you know, it does mean if you say no to a project that's a bad deal for the public, it doesn't mean you're eliminating that from the community. You're probably just reorganizing it into different places. So I do think that's an important differentiation to make.
All right. Any other final comments on that one? All right. Then we'll look for that one as soon as you're ready as well.
Thank you.
Any other business for this afternoon, Mr. Wilkie?
Yeah, two items. One, I just wanted to follow up. I heard pretty broad consensus with the DMC guidelines, having a checklist in there to you know, show what's being met and what's not being met and what the reason was for not being met. But I wanted to check and see if there was consensus for that or if that's something that we should formalize with the vote.
So questions, comments on that? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as I remember the discussion, I mean, not every element is supposed to be in every project.
Right.
So
right.
It's exhaustive, or it just says which ones are one or what?
Well, what would, you know, simply be yes, no, not applicable. But again, you're right, a lot of them are not applicable.
I guess I see input from staff. I mean, how hard is that to do?
Yeah. Mitzi just asked me if John had drafted a checklist. Well, it's actually just that one page. I think it was page number 19. What I think Michael had indicated before, when a project is coming through, to just essentially mark which of the, you know, of those various incentives, you know, are met or which aren't applicable. I don't think, you know, from what I understood when it was discussed, I don't want to speak for planning, but I thought it was something that could be done.
But we're essentially doing that now, just not like a formal checklist, but we are looking at the design standards.
Yeah.
Relative to a project.
Well, I mean, yeah, we've been trying, you know, for the last you know, year plus, we've been, you know, giving the document out to architects and whatever and telling them to try and incorporate the elements of the document into your project as best you can.
We'll use something with the implementation of that design guide, and if you don't like what you're seeing, we can tweak it, right?
That works for me. What I'm really getting at is it's not that every one of these have to be applied to every project, but when they're not applied, I want to see that document and know, okay, the reason it was not applied is because this building doesn't have an exposure on this side or something like that, as opposed to it wasn't done because the developer wanted a floor area ratio. That makes a big difference.
So what would you like to do?
We'll attempt to do that.
I have concerns.
Let's see what staff comes back with, and if we need to change it, we'll change it. But I just wanted to confirm. I never had a formal yes, we are doing some sort of a checklist, so now I have that. The other one I wanted to bring up was I want to talk a little bit about the tall building zone, and just I know we had a ton of things, and I just kind of forgot to bring this up, but there's, you know, community members have reached out to me about certain historic parcels that do we really want to put an inclination of a tall building allowance where that is not necessarily what the intent of the council is. And maybe it is the intent of the council to, you know, put tall buildings on Third Street. But I do think that what we're doing is we're creating a bit of a market pressure to build tall buildings in some of those places by putting it in a tall building zone. And I don't think we would need to exempt very much, but I do think things like the 10 block of Third Street Southwest, the 300 block of South Broadway, the east side of the 200 block of First Avenue are places that we could perhaps exempt from the tall building zone. And then a couple that we maybe consider, like the 10 block of 4th Street Southwest and the Oddfellows building. You know, I don't know if it makes sense to include that in the tall building zone, and if that's not our intent to allow tall buildings there.
Well, I think one of the things that has to be determined if they are historic, in fact, I think Aaron can help out there. On a list, are those areas designated historic, or
it's basically all the buildings downtown that are potentially historic are on the list that was provided to the council. There's a number on there that are not, including Third Street. So the discussion is, do we look at doing a downtown district? And that's something I think that the HPC is going to recommend we do with our consultant when hopefully we get a consultant on board at this month's meeting, or soon at least. So that I think will be one of the first projects for them is to take a look at should we do a downtown district, and if we do, which properties would be contributing elements to that district. But at this time, we've not analyzed the downtown as a district, so we have a list of pretty much all the buildings, well, a lot of buildings downtown that potentially could be part of a district, but you need to have somebody that specializes in the historic review work to take a look at that. To really take a look at downtown and identify which buildings are really contributing resources or not.
Historic Third Street to me should be exempted. I mean, that's a gem. We have this as a gem. It's something that deserves a bit of protection. We have great local businesses that are there that are reviving that area and really made it a popular spot for everyone in town. I have no problem with the protection affording that area. In terms of the other ones, I think we just need to get them on paper so I can take a look contextually and figure out if they make sense. But to me, we have the authority to do it. If we know that there are parts of our city that need that sort of protection, we simply lay it out and move forward.
The problem that I have, though, is they're talking historic. They want to make it historic. I can understand protecting this third, but I'm not. It doesn't truly fit into being historic. So I'm saying,
yeah.
I agree with
that. I'm not going to talk about historic. I think you were about a tall building protection.
Yeah,
I think there's a difference.
Aaron's right. It's a difference between a historic district and an individual historic asset.
Yep.
And we just haven't funded the study of that yet. I expect that we will. But here's the thing I don't want to do. I don't want to go put some of these places into a tall building zone and 6 months later take them out of a tall building zone and have somebody claim that we're doing a taking on them as a result of that.
So the zoning standards are actually going to dictate how many stories you can build on these different properties. And
yep.
If there are specific areas in the downtown that the council does not want to allow even 6 stories on, we should sit down and talk about that, because right now the FAR, permitted floor area ratio would be 6. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily a tall building, but depending on how you shape that, it could end up being quite tall, right? If there, so we can use the zoning and actually define a separate zoning boundary for properties in which you want to maintain more of a historic-like character. It doesn't even have to meet a historic definition, but mm-hmm. a historic-like character, we can do that.
It's even simpler than that, right? We just say we don't want buildings over 3 stories there. Problem solved. I mean, there's authority here to dictate what it should look like.
Yeah.
And I think the key thing, I just like to have this discussion before we say this is tall building zone and zone it that way, as opposed to after the fact. And, you know, if you want me to throw out a map or something as a starting point, I'd be happy to do that.
Please do that.
Well, I think what you said is you get that information to people for convincing and
they Nick said please do it, so if nothing else, I'll do it for him.
Yep. Problem solved.
All right. So we'll have planning take a look at the suggested areas. All right. Anything else? All right. Remember, we have photos this evening. So,
looking at me here.
Yeah.
Look great.
All right. Thank you.